as is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're still on State of Wisconsin versus Edward Bannister, and we'll now hear from Attorney Craig S. Powell representing Mr. Bannister. Corroboration confession.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I shot JFK. Members of the Court may recall in the days following that event in November 1963, hundreds of people came forward making the very same claim. If the State is right in this case, then there was sufficient evidence to convict every one of them for that crime, because there was a body in President John F. Kennedy Jr. dead with a bullet in him. This case presents a similar scenario, albeit in the context of a delivery of a controlled substance charge. We have a unfortunately deceased man based on his use of the drug morphine. That's what we have at the trial evidence. And we have a confession attributed to Mr. Edward Bannister that he gave morphine on uncertain dates to the deceased. That's it. That's all. And that's not enough.
Does this come under false confession, or does it come under no crime? I mean, the concept of corroboration, as explained by the State and in the briefs, is the reason you want corroboration is because people falsely confess, which is the way you started out, and or that there was absolutely no crime. I mean, they say they killed somebody, there's no body, but the guy's missing.
I think, as the State pointed out correctly earlier this morning, it started in Perry's case where, in fact, no crime had been committed.
Right.
But as it has evolved in American jurisprudence, it has been more concerned with the fact that a person may be convicted based on a false confession because of the uniquely powerful evidence that is a confession. It's counterintuitive to anyone not affiliated with the justice system that anyone would consider confessing to something they did not do. But the courts here, in judicial experience, the experience of police officers and attorneys know all too well, especially recently, that these things unfortunately happen with some frequency. And the corroboration rule has been around for a while, but it is, I guess, a last safeguard in place to protect against that happening by testing the evidence that is actually submitted at trial under the rules of evidence, comparing it against the alleged words of the defendant, and determining if, in fact, a significant fact of that confession has been corroborated so as to inspire confidence in the truthfulness of the words attributed to the defendant.
Counsel, as I understand the facts, you have a confession that between December X and January X, I delivered morphine to X. X has morphine in his system. Why would that not constitute corroboration of a significant fact of the confession?
Well, we look at the, for corroboration purposes, we look at the trial evidence apart from the confession. We look at the evidence sort of in a vacuum, I guess you would say. Do these facts established at trial corroborate a significant fact of the words contained in the confession? So here at trial we have an officer who testifies. They find Michael Wolk on his couch. There's a couple syringes on a table and a spoon, a rock of powdery white substance, I believe are the words in the record. You have a medical examiner, not the doctor, but one of the laboratory technicians who says, I tested those materials. There's morphine on the syringes and the spoon. And there's morphine in Mr. Wolk's blood. Dr. Jensen, the medical examiner, gets up and says, this man died of morphine toxicity. Those are the facts, which in essence are Michael Wolk died of morphine toxicity on January 17th, 2003. Looking at the words attributed to Mr. Bannister, they are, I knew a guy named Stephen who possibly had a brother named Michael. Sometime between mid-December 2002 and mid-January 2003, I gave them morphine on 8 to 10 occasions, 3 to 4 occasions to Stephen, 3 to 4 occasions to Michael, every third day or in that range. That is the confession. And
So once again, my question is, if all you need is corroboration of a significant fact of the confession, why doesn't the evidence, and I understand the evidence regarding the death is different, and I understand you have a different argument regarding that, but why isn't the evidence of the morphine in the syringes and the morphine in the blood a corroboration of a significant fact in the confession?
I guess this case may hinge on what exactly is a significant fact. What concerns me about this case in some regard is the circumstances surrounding the confession itself. I know we have a policy now for recording. That wasn't in place at the time. The particular circumstances surrounding this confession, what is produced after this interrogation is essentially nothing but the detective's own words. There's no contemporaneous notes in existence. They were supposedly made and destroyed. There is no statement contemporaneously written in Mr. Bannister's hand. There is no statement contemporaneously written by the detective with Mr. Bannister's signature attached, showing his assent to the version of events that are contained in that statement.
But, Counselor, that doesn't really address the question, which is why isn't the morphine in the body and on the syringes corroboration of the confession that he gave the decedent and or his brother morphine near the time of the death?
That was a long-winded way of getting to the fact that I don't know if there I don't know if you could call any of the facts in that confession significant legally in this sense. This is basically a one size fits all confession. You could plug in myself, learned counsel, Mr. Wren, or anyone in this room into that situation, and they would be convicted of the same crime. Independent.
Explain that, counsel, because you said in your opening when you used the JFK murder and you said there were 100 people that confessed to it. This is, and that, I think this is the question that Justice Butler and Rogensack are asking, and I'll ask it again. That is it the closeness? Is it the amount? Is it significant? There's a relationship here, at least, that you're saying, well, it's in doubt because it wasn't recorded, and now we have a recording requirement. It was in doubt because he didn't keep his contemporaneous notes. And then you said, well, it could be any one of us, but there is some, however insignificant. This person died of morphine toxicity. Mr. Bannister gave morphine to this man and or his brother. But you're saying, well, because he didn't keep any notes, that the corroboration isn't significant because he made it up and the detective had an opportunity to make this up? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm not saying that's what occurred.
The connection is that there was a delivery of morphine for a number of days in December and January, and then there was a death. And one of the people named that he gave the morphine to was a person that passed away. Now, I don't see that. I mean, this seems to, from this thousands, hundreds, now it's coming down to where, well, we're only talking about three people here. So
it has some probative value, I would say. Okay. Whether or not it's legally sufficient to fill the corroboration requirement, it does not.
And why not?
Again, it goes back to, I think, something Justice Butler said earlier today, which is that the state has been focused on the coercive nature of why confessions may be false, only on coercion. But there are other reasons, as we know, why people confess falsely, whether it be from mental illness or maybe want some level of notoriety from such a confession. I think also Justice Butler cited the case from California, I think involved the JonBenet Ramsey murder case from Colorado.
Which was different until they investigated, but here at least there is a relationship. There's some contact, and which was different in your examples. That's all I'm...
Okay. But I think, I don't know what you exactly mean by contact, but the contact established between these two gentlemen is only established through the words of Mr. Bannister.
Okay, and that's not enough is what you're saying.
Right. The trial evidence is only that this gentleman died of a morphine overdose, period.
So suppose instead of finding the drugs in the guy's body, they found it on the night table. Is that going to be, does that corroborate the confession?
I don't think it's any different.
It's no different. Suppose the confession says, and I packaged it all in, you know, the double Glad bags. They're new on the market, and they're really very good. And then the packaged goods in the guy's house, double bagged. Would that be corroboration?
I think it certainly has more probative force. We're getting closer. I'm not sure that's exactly enough to fulfill the requirement, but it's certainly getting closer.
What was the theory of defense at trial?
Essentially challenged the state's evidence as it existed. In closing arguments, if I recall, defense counsel also referred to the brother, Stephen Wolk, in this case, who exercised his Fifth Amendment rights not to testify and suggested that any morphine that his brother may have had came from him. Essentially, it's a challenge to the state's evidence. This is not enough, or this is an alternative theory of maybe where the what the source was.
There was discussion this morning about the effect of the Court of Appeals decision. It was my understanding that the defendant would not be retried. He would be free if the Court of Appeals were affirmed. Is that your view?
Yes, that's my understanding.
Mr. Powell, you seem to indicate that the date connection wasn't enough, that the confession of mid-December, mid-January, I'm making deliveries, and then the death of Mr. Wolk on the 17th of January. But now my understanding from the state's brief, at least, is that they felt there were other things as well that provided corroboration. One was the stipulation that you referred to earlier. I understand that there was a stipulation that morphine in the body of the decedent had probative value in regard to whether or not your client delivered a controlled substance. Also, it's my understanding from the trial evidence that there was nothing at the trial that would indicate any other source of this morphine except your client, that there was nothing about the fact that the Wolk brothers manufactured morphine or provided some other device to get their morphine. Aren't those corroborative facts as well?
First, as to the stipulation, the concession in the stipulation was that the evidence had probative value as to whether the delivery took place. Again, probative value does not equal corroboration. And jumping ahead to our discretionary reversal argument, I won't get into the details of that argument itself, but the facts supporting that particular argument laid out the circumstances surrounding the stipulation, which involved the threat of a homicide charge if you didn't agree to the stipulation. The lower court justice fined his concurrence. Yourself, it should label that as an extortionate request by the state.
Somebody else could say that your client got a break out of that, rather than an extortion situation.
They could.
He didn't face the charge that originally had been brought of negligent homicide, isn't that right?
That charge was never actually brought, Chief Justice. The only charge ever filed was delivery of a controlled substance. Now, perhaps Judge Fine used that phrase because earlier that morning the state, through its prosecutor, had said, we don't have enough evidence to go forward on a homicide charge. That conversation took place previously to the stipulation being entered into. There was much discussion about why they were threatening to bring this case now when hours before they felt they couldn't do so.
Counsel, I wonder if we're dealing with a two-part test or a one-part test with regard to corroboration. And I'm going to posit that we're dealing with a two-part test. I might be wrong, but I'm going to posit it. And that is that the testimony information has to, number one, provide confidence in the truth of the confession, and number two, the evidence has to be corroborative of any significant fact Now, that test isn't novel. That's in Barth, that's in Holt, that's in all of that. That language comes from all of our cases.
Yes.
It isn't clear to me from reading those cases whether it is a two-part analysis or is a one-part analysis. One-part analysis is like we need corroboration in order to enhance the confidence in the truth of the confession. And in order to get that, then you have to have corroboration of any significant facts. So it's like the way that you establish one is by, you know, the confidence of the confession, that the true test is really any significant fact. But I think that maybe the test is two. Corroboration has to provide confidence in the truth of the confession, and it has to be corroboration of any significant fact. Now, it seems to me that the circumstances in this case are just messy. The whole thing is kind of messy. You know, it's not a clean case. You have the writing of Judge Fine, and he points out some at least alleged ethical lapses. You have a case that sounds like everyone's trying to show murder with a confession, but you're really just talking about delivery, and there's just kind of things that are messy here. And then you point out, the police here have a confession, but it's not a signed confession. The underlying notes have been tossed away. So you can make an argument that the circumstances here, and indeed some of the testimony, maybe undermines rather than enhances confidence in the truth of the confession. The second prong would be, is it of any significant fact? And I have a problem with that one. That is, from your point of view, it's a problem. I want to give another hypothetical. Person charged with theft, taking and carrying away movable property of another. I give a confession. Let's say it's me. I confess to theft, and I tell them I took the property, and it's now in my mother's back porch. And they find the property in my mother's back porch. I don't see that all that different than what we have here. You have a confession not for murder charge, but you have a confession of delivery. And lo and behold, the goods appear where the confession says. During this month period of time, I gave some to each of the brothers every two or three days. And then lo and behold, the testimony is they go there, and there's morphine on the syringes and the spoon and the body, and so that's just like the movable property of another theft charge.
Well, I think in your hypothetical, an important fact in that case would be the fact that it's at your mother's house. That may seem small, but it's important if you look at Mr. Bannister's confession. Again, looking at everything outside of his confession, nothing within Mr. Wolfe's residence, near his body, anything at trial connected Mr. Bannister to that delivery or Mr. Wolfe or anything. Nothing.
Well, what if I said it was on my back porch?
Again, that's your house. I think that's a connecting fact that it certainly lends more credence to the confession, I think. It makes it closer to corroboration, if not satisfies the test.
Could I ask, you have the trial, and you have proceedings before trial. Can any of this corroboration be established before trial, or does it all have to be at trial?
Well, I think as the law stands now, this is about the evidence that is brought about at trial. This is about a defendant's right to have the state prove him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. This is an accusatorial system, not inquisitorial system. We want the state to prove their case. We don't necessarily want a defendant to or make a defendant do so out of his own mouth. So I believe that pretrial proceedings in testimony therein aren't relevant to the ultimate question here, which is, did the trial evidence corroborate the person's confession? If you look at the case of Smith, which we've cited in our brief, they kind of go into the history of the corroboration rule a little bit, the rationale for it. The concern is that juries might give undue weight to a confession. They are unable to look critically at someone's confession because, as I mentioned before, it's counterintuitive that someone would confess to something they didn't do. So we're assessing the trial evidence in this case and the sufficiency of what the state has provided in order to prove a person guilty of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. So going back to pretrial evidence, for example, a Miranda hearing, is something of that nature. First of all, the rules of evidence don't apply at those types of hearings. So there are evidence that comes in at those hearings have less guarantees of reliability than you would have at the trial level. I think that's something you have to look at. But I think most importantly, we're talking about the actual trial itself where a person's liberty is put at stake.
Is there any testimony at trial about the defendant's nickname?
No.
Mr. Powell?
Yes.
I'm interested in your position with respect to your arguments regarding 751-06 and Judge Fine's concurrence.
Yes.
And if you would address those, please.
Yes. This court is aware, this court does have the power to reverse a lower court decision in the interest of justice on the part of the basis of the real controversy not being fully tried. In this particular case, we've touched on this already, but I think essentially we had a homicide case in delivery, in the guise of a delivery case. From the outset, the prosecutor's opening argument went right into the death of Michael Wolk. Michael Wolk was repeatedly referred to as the victim in this case, although again, we're dealing with the delivery. Tells the jury up front, I don't want you to decide who's at fault for his death, but we got to talk about it. And we're going to talk about it a lot. And that's the only evidence presented at trial was about the death of Michael Wolk, where they found him, what was in his blood, what the autopsy reports were. Now, going back to the stipulation Justice Crooks asked me about before, that stipulation was, I think, explicitly or was limited to evidence about the death as corroborative. That was satisfied with Susan Gock's testimony about what was in his blood. There was no need to pile on with Dr. Jensen getting up there and saying, well, he also died because of morphine toxicity. That was the purpose of the stipulation had been satisfied with Susan Gock's testimony.
I guess I'm somewhat confused with respect to the stipulation, and I don't know if this was discussed, and if it's not in the record, I don't want you to go outside of the record, but it would seem to me that for purposes of evidentiary value, the importance of the evidence is that there was morphine in the blood of the individual. And I'm not sure why there wasn't a stipulation to that effect and that that individual was unavailable. I'm not sure why death ever had to come in.
I don't think the death had to come in. The state brought it in. There was an objection made by defense counsel prior to Dr. Jensen's testimony, discussed at sidebar. The sidebar was unfortunately not put on the record, so I can't tell the court what the substance of the objection was. But I know when the stipulation was discussed over a lengthy pretrial conference where neither side nor the court could seem to get on the same page, so to speak, about what they were actually trying to get accomplished, I think defense counsel specifically said, I'm not going to stipulate to the fact that there was morphine in the blood.
That's what defense counsel said?
I believe so.
All right.
If the court should go on the grounds of reversal and the interest of justice, would there be a new trial? We established this morning that if it went on the ground that this confession didn't have corroboration, there could be no new trial.
Correct. I think if this court reverses the conviction based on discretionary reversal, believe the remedy is a new trial for Mr. Bannister. I think there are a couple of points I'd like to address from...
You'd prefer the former, of course.
I'm sorry?
You'd prefer the former on corroboration.
The former is warranted, and yes, I would prefer that, Chief Justice. A couple of things I would just like to briefly respond to from this morning. I think I already touched on the fact that the state has talked a lot about coercion and preventing coercion, but as Justice Butler pointed out, this is the corroboration requirement is about truthfulness. And we talk about pretrial hearings like Miranda, and that the corroboration rule does no more than Miranda or videotaping. I think that's incorrect, first of all, because in good trial hearings, especially under Agnello, the truthfulness of a confession has no place in a voluntariness inquiry, and that's what we're looking at here. And as far as videotape being the cure-all for possible false confessions, there are many exceptions, as Mr. Wren pointed out this morning, to the videotape requirement. And we don't know what happens prior to the videotape being turned on, and we don't know what happens in the sometimes surprisingly lengthy car ride between arrest and detention center before the arrest takes place, before the interview takes place. And we've also got, as Justice Rogensack pointed out this morning, instances of videotaped, Mirandized, voluntary confessions that were false. I'd also like to point out, actually, we've already touched on this, the fact that the trial evidence, as Justice Prosser had asked me, the trial evidence is what we should be sticking to in the corroboration inquiry. I see that the warning light is on. If the court has no more questions, I can wrap up. Just ask the court to look at the following. The Court of Appeals applied the correct standard as we know it in the state of Wisconsin, which is that a confession must be corroborated by a significant fact. They stated the standard correctly, and they applied it, and I think they reached the correct result. Accordingly, I ask this court respectfully to affirm the Court of Appeals' decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wren, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. In response to Justice Bradley's question about one- or two-part test, I think it's a one-part test. I think the issue of confidence in the truth of a confession is derivative of the issue of the corroboration of the fact. That's the whole point of doing corroboration, is to try to enhance the confidence in that.
The reason I ask that is I can think of circumstances where you could have testimony that would corroborate any significant fact, or a significant fact, but the overall circumstances yet smell.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though there is corroboration of a significant fact, I could be left with a situation where I have no confidence that this confession is true. So one may not necessarily fulfill the other. It may not be derivative in all cases.
I understand that, but I think that, in fact, the corroboration test is not aimed at getting assurance. It really isn't targeting the actual truth
of a
confession. None of our inquiries are, whether it's Miranda Goodchild, whether it's the videotaping, whether it's the corroboration. There's no assurance from any of those that the confession is actually true. What it's designed to do is to provide some kind of token or an indicium of whether somebody looking at it could, who has the ultimate decision about deciding on its truthfulness, could reasonably assume that there was truth in that.
The standard isn't, and I don't mean to suggest, you know, it's the essence of truth is what I'm pursuing in this case. The standard is whether or not it produces confidence in the truth of the confession. And I'm submitting there can be circumstances when you have actual corroboration of a significant fact, or any, but A would do it, and yet the overall circumstances do not produce confidence in the truth of the confession.
I understand that. I think one of the examples where you could say that there were multiple corroborations were the Central Park jogger cases. And yet corroboration, Miranda, Goodchild, none of those ultimately assure that truth. And it passed all
different. Assuring truth and producing confidence. You know, I'm not talking about ultimate truth. I'm talking about, you know, is there enough there that produces, I'm confident. I might be
there,
wrong, but I'm confident.
Even there, those confessions, ultimately, I mean, I'm not sure that if we step back and look objectively, we would say that we felt confident about the truth when we look at all the circumstances. That would bring us, I think, a different test than what this Court has laid out in Holt. In Holt, we basically said, if you can corroborate any significant fact, then we're going to regard the confession as sufficiently corroborated to be used as for the jury to have relied on it. A more totality of the circumstances kind of test, I think, moves us away from the any significant fact test.
Yeah, the language in subsequent cases is such corroboration is required in order to produce a confidence in the truth of the confession. The corroboration, however, can be less than is necessary to establish the crime independently of the confession. If there is corroboration of any significant fact, that is sufficient.
All right. And I think, to me, that's a one-part test, frankly. I mean, I understand you might see it as a two-part test, but I just see it as a one-part test. So, on the issue of the extortion and so on, the question, the allegation, the assertion was made that an out-of-court declaration by the prosecutor had been made, that they didn't think they had sufficient evidence to go forward. I didn't get a sense from the transcript that, I mean, the judge was not involved, and that was simply a representation by the defense attorney. As I recall, the actual prosecutor who was involved in that conversation was not in the courtroom. One of the other assistant DAs was actually involved in that. The assistant DA who allegedly made that representation arrived later, I think, at the time. But I didn't get a sense from reading the transcript that the judge took that at face value. I would note that when Mr. Bannister was arrested, Detective Carchese said he arrested him on two offenses. He arrested him on the Len Bias charge, the first-degree reckless homicide, and the delivery charge. And the prosecutor at some point made a decision to go ahead with the delivery charge. There are any number of reasons why it wouldn't surprise me what the prosecutor said. It's just going to be easier to get this. Not that I don't have enough. It's just going to be easier to get the delivery charge. So, if there are no further questions from the court.
I have one last question. What about the opening statement of the prosecutor referring to Stephen Wolf's testimony when, in fact, Stephen Wolf invoked his Fifth Amendment privilege during the course of the trial?
I think the assertion by Judge Fine was that he didn't think there was anything in the record to suggest that the prosecutor had a good faith belief. I don't know whether he had a good faith. I don't know what the prosecutor was thinking when he said if he should testify. I just don't know. I wouldn't want to, shall we say, defend that approach to presenting the possible testimony of a witness. At the same time, I think that it's useful to look at the fact that there were several comments about Mr. Wolk in the opening statement by Mr. Bannister's attorney. And at the same time, Mr. Bannister's attorney did not object to the references to Steve Wolk. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wren, and thank you, Mr. Powell, for your arguments today on corroboration. We're glad we're going to be the 17th published case on this subject in the state of Wisconsin. That concludes our hearing on 2005 AP 767 CR State of Wisconsin versus Edward Bannister. We will now call our next case, and I should offer an apology to counsel. We ran late because there was a fire drill because of a defective smoke alarm system. Just so happened it was in the court's area. So that's why we're running late.